Today's interview is with Megan Sneddon. Now, Megan's a friend of mine who travels the world capturing crazy adventures and amazing cultural stories through photography and film and writing. And she's done work with a lot of the most popular magazines and online outlets, including BBC, National Geographic, Men's Journal. She's also created short films and done photography for travel brands like Tourism Tasmania and Expedia. I love talking to Megan because she's super passionate about teaching people how to overcome adversity. After she lost her brother to a car accident and her dad to a plane crash, and also briefly having gone blind from an autoimmune disease, Megan often speaks on radio shows and before live audiences about how she transformed her tragedies into sources of strength and how she was able to cultivate optimism and the power of travel in facilitating these things. She's traveled to over 20 countries, and her wildest travel experiences include producing a segment with Larry the Cable Guy in Brooklyn's Russian neighborhood, racing horses with cowboys in Argentina, setting a Guinness World Record for most surfers on a wave in Ireland, and participating in the world's biggest food fight. This is a great interview. Hope you enjoy it. So Megan, I want to start this interview with you still do journalism and stuff now and a lot of writing. At what age did that start? Like when did you start getting interested in that, and when did you start doing that stuff?
Great question. Let's see if I can trace it back. You know what's really funny about this is, when I was younger, I really struggled with reading. I remember being in eighth grade and like the teacher calling upon me to read something out loud, and I looked at the words on the page and I couldn't even decipher what in the heck it said. So they ended up putting me in like kind of special ed classes to learn how to read. And at that point, I hated it because I was getting so much attention around, you know, everyone was concerned about my inability to figure out how to read, but that special attention too probably played into what developed as my interest. I guess I started like writing poems and journaling and all that kind of stuff when I was a teenager, so like taking a greater interest in expressing myself in the written word. And then I guess I didn't even know that I was going to end up in a career in writing, because I even graduated from college and had no idea what I wanted to do. But I just kind of stuck with my interests, you know, started a blog. And it's always been something as a creator, just something that I've rolled with. And then there's been waves of, wrestling between, well, am I a photographer? Am I a writer? Because photography came into play when I got my first camera and I graduated from college and had actually moved to New York. I think even at the time that I met you was like apprenticing under a photographer for Vogue, thinking I was going to go that direction. And it's been this like not very well orchestrated plot that's led me a lot of cool places.
You know, it's funny, you're the second guest I've been told, and all of my guests are very brilliant, accomplished people. You're the second guest that's told me they were put in special ed. But when you were a teenager, when you started writing poems, was that a hobby, or did that come about when you were in class, or like, did your parents know you were doing that? Was that something you were just kind of doing on your own?
Yeah, it was just, I think my first journal I had bought at a school book fair, and it had like moons on. I still have it. It kind of just became a place for me to express how I was feeling and what I was thinking, and to try to make sense of it. And of course, a lot of what I was writing was about failed romance and and boy crushes at the time. But then kind of, you know, took a more serious turn when I got older. I had, for people that know, lost my brother when I was really young, which is, I think, part of what played into my struggle with school when I was younger, because it was a lot to deal with as a kid. But then the journaling and the writing became kind of a form of, you know, sense making in terms of that loss, and then turned into, well, what does my life mean? And with that whole jazz.
So it was just kind of self-exploration, basically. You were using writing as then. Interesting.
Yeah.
In what age did you start getting into photography?
Not until college. I took maybe one photography class in school. I only had one camera, and it wasn't very technical. But then I think my dad saw that I liked it, and parents got me a camera as my graduation gift. And it was right after college, actually, when I got that camera. I don't know, I just felt really drawn to it. I got a writing job in the marketing department of a photography school out in Santa Barbara. And it didn't pay a whole heck of a lot, but it hit it off really well with the director there. And he's like, hey, you can, you know, take workshops and stuff as long as you are, you know, helping me out with things. And so as I started taking more and more workshops and meeting photographers there, then that interest kind of developed. And then suddenly kind of, I mean, I'm always a writer, you know, so I'm in the background, I'm, you know, journaling and kind of that, I don't know, writing for my own pleasure, and of course reading, which I love, but then seriously considering a career in photography at that point.
So you'd been writing for a long time. You didn't start photography until college. What kind of stuff were you doing apart from journaling, or not from apart from journaling, apart from like writing poetry and writing angsty journal entries about the people that you were in love with? Like, when was the first time you actually got hired or paid or did something professionally related to either writing or photography?
Let's see. I'd say a couple references. In college, I ended up working for the newspaper there. I started out as a reporter and then moved up to an editorial position. And so was working for the newspaper. I think I did a couple like brief internships for local newspapers and stuff. And what I loved about the news department most was just the community. And also that was another aspect of something that nurtured my writing, because I would, you know, it was a daily newspaper. So I was there every single day writing stories. And I had editors at the time that were sitting by my side, combing through my work, you know, because then when I was a reporter and they wanted to groom me to be an editor, then they were literally training me side by side for hours every day at that point. And then I remember thinking in high school, like, maybe there's something here, because there were a few writing competitions that I entered into and won. I think one of them was like some small magazine called Starting Lines, and I won $100 for a personal essay. But like $100 when I was 16 was like an incredible amount of money. So that got me really excited. And, you know, the other thing, I'm so embarrassed to admit this. I won like homecoming when I was in high school. And I remember they were supposed to give a bio about me, and they were like, oh, so what do you, you know, it was senior year. And she's like, oh, what do you want to put down is for what you want to be when you graduate? I'm like, I have no idea. And then she just said, well, I think you're going to be a journalist, so I'm just going to put that. And I remember them reading it over the loudspeaker and me, you know, waving and doing the whole homecoming thing. but just having no idea what in the heck it even meant to be a journalist at that point. But yeah. I'm like, all right, I guess I'm destined to do something with that. Better figure it out.
So basically, you were able to pinpoint your career trajectory back on some random person announcing to everyone else that you were going to be a journalist. You felt that you were now obligated to become a journalist.
Yeah, someone else chose my fate. Boy, yeah, was I lucky.
It's too bad she didn't say, you know, she's going to be swept up by Prince Charles or whatever.
I know, God.
Or Prince William. Or, I don't know.
Why did you come up with something else? I don't
know. Yeah. She's going to be a millionaire who sits around collecting lottery tickets.
She's going to be a billionaire, a gazillionaire, yeah. She should have said that.
Effortlessly, yes, through the power of God.
Effortlessly going to become... She's going to own all the planets in the universe.
Yeah, that fortune teller did not hook you up with a better job of doing nothing.
No, she didn't say, like, I'm going to be a rodeo clown or something. That seems like a hard job.
That's true. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm always interested in how people found... like that they liked what they were doing, like the talents that they had, you know, because all of us have these talents, right? Or these latent talents, or these areas that we could dive deeply into. Like, it's not like you're good at reading and writing and photography. You know, you're probably good at a bunch of other stuff, like winning homecoming. You're clearly good at that. To stick with writing, to stick with photography. Why did you stick with those things? What appealed to you about them? And was it effortless sticking with them, or?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would go as far as effortless.
Effortless, but like a no-brainer.
Yeah. Yeah, that. I mean, not necessarily a no-brainer, actually. I've tried out a lot of other things. It's just that when I tried out other jobs, I would just go, meh, and just naturally gravitate back to them. And I remember when I was working at the newspaper senior year, I decided to, or was it junior? Anyway, sometime around then, I decided to go study abroad and live in Spain. And one of my friends, when she had studied abroad, who also worked for the newspaper, scored a weekly column where she got to write about her travel experience. And I really loved reading her articles. And then when I decided to go abroad, I convinced the editors to let me do exactly the same thing. So when I was living in Spain and I was there and I got to write these stories, I fell in love with that because it was something that went into a newspaper, but it was so personal and it was so wild, you know, in a certain degree, because it was about travel. And there was something deeper there to me than just writing about like water district issues or like the finance board meeting that week and doing, you know, typical newsy type stuff. Something that was almost on a philosophical level. And I think when I was doing that too, even though I wasn't professionally trained in photography yet, it kind of, those two things are conduits of like the two sides of my personality, which is like when I'm like the thinker, you know, who could sit down and is kind of introverted and quiet and write, and I like to spend time alone. But then the other half, the photography side, is like the extroverted person who likes to interact and connect with people and like explore and wander and be like, ooh, what's that? You know, so it's like both elements combined into something. And I really, so I really stumbled upon something when I did that. And then after I graduated, you know what, I wrestled a lot because I had these paradoxical voices that were like, do what you love, but get a real job. Like, yeah. Travel journalism, that would never be a real job. And so it wasn't necessarily an effortless pursued in that regard, because I did try getting real jobs. I got, you know, I worked in offices. I, you know, slept a lot in like restaurants, meanwhile, just sitting at home being like, what do I do? And then
sorry to interrupt you, Megan. What would you define as a real job?
I don't even know, but I think I would define it at this point as something that other people tell you to get when they don't think that what you're doing is a worthy cause, or when it puts them into some type of fear. I spent years trying to figure out what that was.
Right. To me, it's just a socially accepted job. It's just a normal thing to people because so many people do them that we've all accepted as a group that, yes, that is a real job. To me, what should be a real job is the job that you create for yourself, the one that's meaningful to you, because that's actually not only more fulfilling, it's more difficult. It's way more difficult to design something for yourself and to try and make it work than it is to show up day after day being told what to do by other people. Like, I don't know about you, but after I got out of school, I was like, I am done listening to other people's ridiculous agendas that don't have anything to do with stuff that I want to do, you know? And it's like, we are all blessed with 24 hours in a day. For people to tell you to get a real job in the world that they've been convinced is the acceptable one is trying to unplug people from the matrix to get them to see the other way around, you know. And obviously people that listen to this are open to that other reality, and at least they have the desire to explore it. But to me, it's just like, at this point in my life, it's just such a no-brainer to hang out with people who do stuff like what you do and actually pursue stuff that makes them feel good and affords them interesting experiences that enrich their consciousness and their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it's just kind of like whatever works for you, you know, if having a boss and a structure, like a 9-to-5 structure and something stable is meaningful to you, then that's great. And if you feel fulfilled by that, then that's great. I think it's just that never worked for me. I just have this like crazy creative brain. I'm really antsy. I love to be outside, you know, playing with people and interacting, and I'm always coming up with projects and stuff like that. So being locked down to a desk never has worked for me. And my work patterns are also extremely irregular. You know, like I can get things done really fast, like 2 or 3 hours of, you know, doing research and writing and stuff. And it's like, boom, you know, I have part of an article done. I don't work well in an 8 hour straight structure. You know, I like to wake up in the morning and
I don't think anyone does.
Do a chunk of work and then, you know, do something else. Or I like the ability to control my own schedule and also have that space there for adding on more things to do, like more collaboration and more, you know, more things. Versus the hardest part for me about working within that construct was somebody telling me no all the time, like, no, that's weird, or, you know, that the, like, there's so many social norms that belong in an office, and, like, I don't know, I'm kind of a little bit quirky, so fitting into that was like, that could work for me.
Yeah. Well, I want to be fair here, because I think it's, you know, it's easy to kind of shit on that type of work style of like, oh, you know, being in an office is terrible, but that's the majority of people, you know? So, and I think not only, and I'm not trying to placate or pander to those people, but what I really want to talk about with you is how awful and hard our choice of pursuing our own path can be. It can be way worse in a lot of instances.
Let me tell you about how it's been worse.
I mean, tell me about it.
God, I mean, just talk about a road that's paved with self-doubt, being surrounded at certain times by naysayers that are like, wait, you want to do what? That's hard, so having to abandon relationships that with people who didn't support what I was doing, that was extremely hard.
What happened? What kind of stuff happened?
Like rifts within my family, just maybe them having expectations of their own of what I was going to end up doing one day, and me being like, no, I want to travel these places and go all over the world and take photos and write. And them, I didn't come from a travel family, so that was difficult for them to understand. Early days before, after I graduated and I started travel and being in a relationship with someone that didn't understand that desire either and having to end it. And just learning how to develop a new supportive community. Meanwhile, watching a lot of my friends get jobs and be secure and safe and have a stable income and know exactly where they belonged every single day. And me still, having cycles of WTF, where, journalism can be up and down. Like, you constantly have to be selling yourself. When you stop selling yourself, the work doesn't come in. There's tons of rejection. And I've gotten, I've paid a lot of money in life coaching to learn how to not personalize that and learn a healthy way to deal with it and not give up. Travel itself involves a lot.
I want to pause you there for a second.
Yeah.
Yes, rejection is a huge part of anybody's life who takes risks, and it's a part of life. And you made the decision to pay for coaching to help you get through this. Did you go through any rejection that almost made you quit? And what made you make that decision to get a coach? How did you know to do that?
Yeah, the first life coach I ever worked with, it must have been like a year after college. I just had these desires to get out into the world and travel, and I was surrounded by people at that time that were like, naysayers, that's not kosher, you need to get a real job, this is irresponsible, the economy's tanking, get on board while the things are going upward, so there was like this me inside that wanted to get out when all these people around me that are like, no. And I just had to find out for myself, like, okay, is everyone else in my life right? Or am I actually right? And what do I even want to be doing? So the life coaching, it wasn't even to deal with rejection at the time. It ended up becoming that later, as I was working through my career, it was more like, okay, how can I get clear on what I want to be doing and start forming a supportive community around these, my own desires and becoming an independent free person and just go for it. And at the time I was like, I want to move to Argentina, maybe even do some volunteer work while I'm there, see where I can pitch articles to, start a blog. I had my camera. I was like, I want to play with that. And so that person that I brought in was like, on the strategic front, helping me work through all of the questions and roadblocks I had on an emotional level and on a, on the more tactical level. And then there was like the whole other emotional side of like all of my childhood programming and stuff that told me that that's not like a normal and okay thing to do, so that I can move all of that away out of my way and just go for it. And I think it was like, I had so many people telling me no, and that I just was like, forget, I'll show them. And yeah, also,
how did you decide that rather than being like,
I don't know,
maybe these people are right.
It's like, I know that this is so crazy, but I had this like intuitive calling. I was like, I know that I just am supposed to go to Argentina.
I didn't, you know, spend all this time in college studying Spanish to not learn how to actually freaking learn how to speak Spanish. Like, I'm ready to get out of my hometown. I'm freaking sick as hell of my damn self. I'm tired of myself, you know, staying home and being like, oh, spinning my wheels. I just need to take action and do something. And also just was, I was so curious about travel and going to live abroad that I knew that I didn't want to become one of those people that like gets married and always has that notion in my head of maybe and never follows through on it and then suffers my whole life out of curiosity of the unknown. I was like, I need to just make this happen so that I can appease that part of myself that wants to know so bad so that I can actually see if it's legit. And the worst case scenario, I go, I freaking hate it. I never want to travel again. I hate Argentina. It was a waste of time. I stay for a week vacation. I come home. That was my worst case scenario. So I'm like, okay, yeah, worst case scenario, I show up, I freaking hate it, and I come home. Like, that's not the worst case scenario. That's not that bad of a worst case scenario.
I love that. So, it's the worst case scenario is I have a bad week-long vacation.
I know, right? Right, because no one's asking me to do anything. I don't have to go and like write a book or any whatever, you know. Like, so I just knew that I needed to go. And if anything, if not for the whole career, the whole whatever, it was like I needed to get the hell out of my college town and go somewhere different, meet different people. I need to like just get out, just for a hot second, so that I can like feel and experience something new. And it just so happened that, like, I put all these plans in place and got there and loved it. And I ended up staying in Argentina for a year and then just kept rolling with it and was like, oh, well, now that I've gone here, I want to go here and here and here and here and here. And it just developed into this whole thing that I didn't even anticipate.
Yeah. So how were you able to make that happen? You know, a lot of people want to do exactly that, but they're, oh, you know, I don't have the funds to do that. It's not practical. You know, I gotta keep my real job. Like, how were you able to do that?
Oh, dude, let me tell you something about freaking craziness. I mean, the good part is that I'm actually writing something right now to get all of those questions answered for people. So I'll have something coming out next year about that. But on a personal level for me, like, everyone's got roadblocks. And I had some freaking crazy roadblocks.
Yeah,
like did. I like to say that I used to have an autoimmune disease. Like, technically I still have it because it's genetic, but I had arthritis. And the craziest part for me was that I was like, how am I going to handle having, you know, all these medications I'm supposed to take and like health issues and like my immune system, because of the meds I was taking was like a small fraction of the normal person's immune system, so which put me at risk for getting like really, really sick, you know. And then if you like to make matters crazy worse, like I literally bought my ticket for Argentina, was like, I'm going, and then I had this crazy thing happen. My inflammation just like crazy flared up, it attacked my eyes, and I ended up going blind for about 6 months. And in the lead up,
completely blind.
But in a weird way, it's like reverse blindness, because it's like your optic nerve is like so inflamed that it can't control the amount of light that's coming in. So it was like white blindness, like everything was so bright that I couldn't see. So, and I mean, unless I put like shades over my eyes and et cetera. So it was a really weird, it's a strange condition, but, so, and even then I was like, what am I thinking, you know? And doctors like, you cannot go abroad, travel with this condition. It's like the worst idea, like the worst idea in addition to things flaring up. So, luckily, you know, I was working with my life coach still at that time. She's like, okay, look, it is curable, you know, so just like play by the rules for a while to get everything to settle down again, because, and then even though I couldn't see, she's like, you need to spend time journaling about, the way that you want to see the world, just to keep the hope alive and keep your dreams real, you know, and like find ways to deal with the stress and get that all to calm down. And it's a good thing that this came up now versus being there, so that you can do your research to find out ways to deal with it in case it comes up when you're there. I mean, good news is that, like, I found ways through food and other natural remedies to just, like, get rid of that whole autoimmune thing, and I'm no longer on medication, so I don't have to deal with that anymore. But, yeah, I mean, it was just, like, one step at a time, you know? Mm. Like, figuring out what my biggest barrier was to what I was doing. And at that time, it was like, whoa, this disease is crazy. What do I do? And then breaking it down into smaller steps of, like, okay, what's my first question, you know? And also, like, using that 6 degrees method of who can I get connected to, you know, that can I find a buddy down there if I need, you know, transport to a hospital, they have a car, or can I find someone that knows the hospital system really well? And, you know, that, you know, so before that I went, I had, like, the names of 4 different specialists. I had someone with a car in case, like, something really happened. And I just, one by one, answered all those questions. So I no longer had an excuse not to go.
Yeah. Plus, so you played out all the worst case.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I'm like, if this, then this. If this, then this. I, like, had answers to everything. Well, not everything.
Yeah.
There's plenty of things that come up that you don't have the answer to. But at least the things I felt like that would hold me back from doing what I was doing, I at least had that all figured out. And the added thing to that was I suddenly have these people that are going to hold me accountable, because I have, you know, like, 4 people that I was calling being like, oh, I'm going to move there and I'm going to travel and do this. And they're checking up and being like, yo, when are you coming? You know, so...
Yeah.
And then there was, like, that added factor of, like, guilt of being like, oh, I've done so much work and they've given me so much. I can't fail them, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that can technically, I've seen that backfire. And I think there are statistics when you announce a major project and say you're working on it, that it can actually put you in a fearful state of mind and you actually are more likely to back out. But in this case, or you know, it can go both ways, actually, if you announce it and hold yourself accountable to it. That's the key thing. You held yourself accountable. And I love that you played out the worst case scenarios and then came up with solutions to them before they happened, because that not only doesn't give, or it not only removes the excuses, but it also makes you feel much safer and more mentally committed.
That, and it also made me see, at a time that my confidence was waning, what I was capable of figuring out.
Mm.
And so figuring out those things before I even got there gave me the confidence to be like, okay, I was able to figure these things out. That means when I get there, other stuff's going to come up that I can't even predict. And I'm going to figure that out too.
Yeah.
Because I was able to figure out other things.
Right. So you had that underlying confidence. So you put the system in place. You have these scenarios figured out so you can actually go on this trip. But then you go to Argentina. Things are great. You're there for a year. How do you pull that off? Financially and practically?
How did I pull that off? I mean, before I left, I had a goal number of, like, how much money I wanted to raise. And because I was just really excited about it, I took a crazy number of, like, random jobs. I was like, I'll get money from it, from everywhere. I mean, as long as it's moral. You know,
how much did you need?
I didn't even feel like I needed that much because it's so cheap. I think I raised, like, I don't know, maybe $7,000 or $8,000 to go down there with, just because I want. And I've traveled with less than that, far less.
Yeah.
It's just that at that time in my life, I was like, this is what I want to feel safe. This is what makes me feel safe.
Yeah. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
I think I came up with literally the exact same amount. I think it was $7,000 or $8,000.
But it's just coming up with the number that makes you feel good, you know, like based on whatever calculation.
And it motivates you because when you realize it's just $7,000 or $8,000 to go do what it is that you want to do, that's pretty attainable. I mean, you can figure out all sorts of ways to make that money.
Mm-hmm. And I also was already tinkering with stuff before I went there. You know, I was asking other expats, like, how are you making money while you're there? And so that I had things to answer to when I got on the ground. Like, I taught English because friends of friends of friends were teaching English, and they hooked me up with the teaching jobs. So I was able to, like, teach English. I got a job cocktailing at a bar that turned out to be, like, a transvestite bar. And I was only there for a couple weeks, and that's a funny story. But the odd thing is, like, I ended up meeting somebody at the bar that was, he ran his own, like, environmental NGO /, like, social network. And I ended up leaving the bar to go work for him. So then I was, like, writing grants for him in English and Spanish, because I was doing, like, translation work. And because right when I got on the ground too, I had a private Spanish tutor, so that I could, like, my Spanish went from, like, 0 to 100. So suddenly I'm, like, bringing in translation work. I mean, you just have to, if you were to do something like what I did at the time, I was open to anything. And then I ended up, like, moving to a horseback riding ranch and, like, leading 6 hours of, like, horseback riding tours a day. And then in addition to, I think, did I write? Yeah, there was a newspaper back in San Ynez, California, that hired me to write a regular column for them. And they were only paying me, like, $75 an article. But that was a lot of money in Argentina, you know, because it's, like, four to the dollar back then. So it's just, yeah. I think it was a certain degree of open-mindedness, a certain degree of, like, setting up connections, like, doing research and, I mean, logistics-wise with, like, visas and stuff. yeah, it's just kind of like...
That's a whole mess. But, I mean...
There's ways to the madness, yeah.
Yeah, the point I wanted to make is that, like, not only is this stuff very possible, Megan was able to travel all around the world writing stories and taking beautiful pictures and seeing these countries that she wanted to see. And you did it by just picking a number that you knew would work, and finding a bunch of different ways that you were cool with earning money, and adding to that bottom line. And again, I think it's smart that you figured out, all right, what are these emergency scenarios? Like, you were freaking blind, for God's sakes, for part of it. So you had to account for that. And so, yeah, I mean, like, this stuff is all doable. I think a big thing, though, that prevents a lot of people is they don't actually want to do it. You know, when it boils down to it, like, it would be nice for them to do, but they don't feel the pain of not doing it. And you felt the pain.
I did. That's exactly what motivated me. I was like, I cannot live the rest of my life not knowing what this is going to be like for me.
Right. And you were tired of where you were living. You were tired of your routine. And like you said, you couldn't have gone through the rest of life without at least scratching that itch, knowing what it was that you were missing. And I think everyone who says they want to do something but never ends up doing it is actually saying, you know, I don't really want to do it. Because if they really wanted to do it, they'd freaking do it. Like, it does not cost a lot of money to go to another country. It does not take a lot of time. It does not throw your world into total chaos. It's not like you lose everything if you go, in Megan's words, take a bad week-long vacation. Like,
yeah,
totally doable.
Yeah. And you know, what's been really, really cool about the journey I've been on is that I've met so many different types of travelers. I've met families, I've met old people, I've met people that have, like, surmounted cancer to go on trips, or people that actually are sick. You know, like, I've met people with a ton of different stories that have made it work somehow.
Yeah. So I don't mean to have this go too much in the direction of, like, how do I travel and work at the same time, but I just always thought it was really cool that you were able to do what so many people claim that they want to do. You actually did it. And I think, you know, for the people who want to do the kind of stuff that you did, they just need to realize that it's very, very possible. I have another friend named Alex List who, you know, she spent 6 months traveling around the world making a documentary about couch surfing.
And you mentioned her before.
Yeah, she raised $8,000 on Kickstarter, and she hustled every country she visited. I think she visited like 13 countries. In every country she was in, she was crashing with couch surfers, and she was able to do that, to live her dream for 6 months with other people's money. You know,
so cool.
That stuff is available to all of us now. It's democratized. Yeah. Like it just takes a little planning.
No joke. Like the thing that ended up blowing my mind the most is I started out just doing what I was really excited about and working through those barriers and just funding it myself. Mm-hmm. And then doing it long enough where I started getting approached by people who wanted to pay me to travel for them.
What?
And I'm like, drop the mic.
Yeah.
Like, I have companies that either pay for all of my travel expenses or pay me to do it.
Oh, yeah. Like National Geographic and BBC and stuff.
No, actually, the publications like don't pay for travel at all.
Oh, they don't. So what are the scenarios? How were you able to transition into...
I started doing like video work, which felt like a natural next step from photography, and then I had.
Yeah, you're really good at that, by the way. I've seen your work.
Merci. So I started out just making videos for funsies, and then some brands saw them online and were like, dude, we want to pay you to make that video for us. Like, how much is that going to cost? Give them a price, and they're like,
how did they find you?
You know, social media, like, okay. I go to a lot of networking events, you know, stuff like that, and they would just see my stuff and be like, we want to make that. And here's the other thing that blew my mind is, like, every country has a tourism board, which is, it has money funneled to it from the government to, I don't want to say every country because it's different in all cases, but they should have a certain allotment of money per year to, like, send journalists to their country for free to experience traveling there and then, like, write about it, document, share it on social media. So literally I took a 10-day trip to Fiji everything was paid for, and I was, like, getting flown around in private jets and, like, staying at top of the top, like, luxury hotels. And, I've gone to Costa Rica and gone to these, like, eco luxury retreats and, like, just mind-blowing stuff that I'm like, wait, is someone really paying for it? It was like having a sugar daddy without any of the...
so the country's tourism board was paying you to do this?
They were paying, like, they'll fund your travel and stuff like that. Yeah, if you're working on a project.
What kind of project?
So anything, you know, things for publications and stuff like that.
Oh.
Or travel guides or magazines, newspapers, and.
Does it specifically have to be travel related in order for them to justify it?
If it's from the tourism board, then yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's awesome. So, those opportunities are out there. And it's a matter, you probably found that out through, like, a fellow journalist or something, right? Like,
it literally fell into my lap, and I think I'm glad that I didn't die when it happened. Like, the email that I got, the first one, it was from Puerto Rico, and they're like, we want to send you on this trip. Like, I literally clutched my chest and fell to the floor. And I'm glad that, because I was like, I'm sorry. I had to call the woman and she's like, hi, yes, this is Megan Sneddon. And I had this email come through about this trip, and I just, the expense that's involved, I'm curious about this. She's like, no, we'd be paying for your whole trip. And it's like that scene from Love Actually, when the girl's at the door and she has that, like, sexy guy coming home, and she goes, can you hold on for a second? And she, like, goes around the other side of the door and, like, has this freak out and then comes back. It's kind of like that, where I'm like, wait, hold on.
Gotta act professional.
Yeah. I had gone to a travel conference and I guess hit it off with the people from Puerto Rico Tourism, left them my card, and then they contacted me because they looked at my website and invited me to go.
That's awesome.
But I didn't even know that was a thing. But I mean, I'm not telling people to pursue tourism boards necessarily. I'm just saying, look what opens up when you just do what you want. Like, that was so, I was blindsided by that. I did not even know that was a thing. I didn't even know that that existed. And then like, oh, crap.
You know, and it's not exactly what you just said, but it's close. You said, you know, when these kind of opportunities open up when you do what you want. That's part of the equation, but the other part is that you have to be good. And let's talk a little bit about that. We're getting close to an hour now, but I want to. There are a lot of people writing, right? And there are a lot of people who take photographs. Like Instagram is full of people who can actually take pretty decent photos consistently. So how did you get good? Like, how did you get good at your craft, and how did you package yourself in a way in super competitive industries with a lot of other talent? How did you sell yourself in a way that people wanted what you were offering?
Yeah, I mean, I've studied a lot. I've taken a lot of classes. I'll tell you something super nerdy. This is how hungry I was, okay? When I first moved to New York, I knew what I wanted. You know, I wanted to work in journalism, but I was working in a restaurant. And no joke, yeah, so nerdy, I would read fiction book upon fiction book. I was reading everything I could get my hands on, newspapers, everything. And I was, like, highlighting vocabulary words, highlighting, like, rhetoric and different sentence structures that I really enjoyed. I was writing them on flashcards. And I would go to work at the restaurant, and I would, like, tuck my flashcards in my pocket. And when I had downtime, I was standing in the back of the restaurant, like, studying flashcards. So I was just, like, reading, studying, so I could get really good at what I was doing. And that was even the point of moving to New York, too, was I was, like, apprenticing under a really incredible photographer so that I could learn what I was doing. And I was still doing a lot to keep learning. So I guess, I don't know, just getting feedback from people was really helpful.
What kind of feedback? Like, how would you solicit feedback?
Like, I'm trying to think. Asking people to coffee that worked in the industry and being like, look, can you read one thing I wrote, you know, or look at these photographs and tell me what you think. Someone I knew also worked for, like, Travel and Leisure and lived in L.A. Like, when I met her, I was like, I'm driving to your house in L.A. Like, I went the distance to meet with important people and get their feedback and thoughts on, like, what I was doing. And then when I was taking all these courses and stuff, just asking teachers for feedback and making, you know, packs with different friends who also wanted to get into the industry, like, for feedback. And so constantly, you know, kind of taking classes and reshaping things and trying things out. And but then simultaneously, as I'm getting better and better, making all the connections that I felt like I needed. And not asking them for much, you know?
Never. Yeah, that's so critical. It's like, when you do make an ask, it's almost in a way that you're complimenting them or giving them something, you know? So, like, when you ask them to read something that you wrote, you're probably not asking them to read, 10,000 word article. You're maybe asking them to read a couple paragraphs. So it's not like a homework assignment. And you're also asking them, because you admire them and you make that clear. So it's like, it's flattering to them. It validates that they are the higher status person, and it gives them room to dispense advice, which everyone who's made it to the top in their industry loves to give to people that are earnest and will actually do something with that advice. Go ahead.
Okay, so one of the most impactful connections I made, and this is important because I want to share like how I went about it, and the intention behind what I did. So I stumbled across this woman's blog, and she happened to be an editor at the Huffington Post, and I read her bio, and it was about how her parents had died, and she had done all these amazing things, and I was really moved by her story, and it was like not long after my dad had died. So I reached out to her and I wrote her an email and I said, hey, you know, I'm really inspired about where you're at in your career because I feel like that's where I'm going. But like you, you know, I've also lost a parent and I just want to hear your story of like how you made it through that emotional event and still managed to be successful. And I said, can I buy you coffee? And she said, yes. And I had the intent, not showing her any of my work, like just listening to her. And just getting her, not even getting advice, but just like listening to her story of like how she survived what she went through and genuinely connecting to her. And it just so happened that in the context or the course of our conversation that we connected about our mutual losses. And then it was a natural segue to start talking about travel. I mentioned in passing, like, oh, yeah, I lived on a horseback riding ranch with gauchos in Argentina and took these incredible photos. And she goes, oh, really? Can I see them? And then I showed her the photos, and she was like, wow, I really like them. I want to publish them. And so then I walked away with an invitation. I had no expectations of what was going to happen at this meeting. Neither was I ever going to approach her and be like, hey, I really want to get published, you know. But it just so happened that she made an ask of me and I sent her my stuff. And then that was my first publication in the Huffington Post, which then led to like other things down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was just really cool to be able to approach people on a really genuine, authentic, like human level.
Yes.
With a desire to just learn about them, essentially. Yeah. And to, by coincidence, walk away with something that ended up being really big.
Totally. And this is probably the most important lesson you knowingly or unknowingly gave in this interview. I think it's beautiful, which is a lot of people have a real resistance to selling. They associate it with feeling like a used car salesman. They associate it with manipulation. And they just don't like it. It makes them feel gross. Now, you were able to not only land your first publication from this meeting, but that also led to other things, paid gigs and stuff. And I think the lesson here is not to ask everybody, hey, can I buy you coffee? I just want to hear your story in the hopes that serendipity will lead to more money or whatever, or more, you know, whatever your career goal is. The lesson here is that everybody wants to connect. Everybody wants to share their story. Everybody wants to develop meaningful relationships with other people. In this world of very superficial, surface-level interactions and this feeling of isolation that all of us have. But the reality is all of us have money to spend. All of us have connections to other people who have money to spend and have problems that they need to solve. And this lady's problem was that she needs to fill her publication with great content. That's her job. And Megan, you solved that problem for her the second she saw your photos because she saw how great they were. And it was an effortless sell because you had already invested the time into genuinely knowing her as a person and you had found that common ground that both of you had over your mutual losses and travel. And I think that's so critical is people feel like sales is manipulative and car salesy because they go for the sale too early, you know, and you should be acting in everybody's best interest. And the way that you do that is by getting to know them as a person first and listening to them and actually hearing them out and understanding them on a very real human level and being sincere.
Yeah.
because as soon as you do that, the sale is effortless.
I almost feel like sales has a scent.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has a smell, you know, like you can, when someone's trying to walk up and sell you something, you're like, oh, I can smell that right away.
Yeah, it's the exact same with being in a bar, and you know that the guy is just trying to hook up with you. Like he's, mm-hmm. because he's just acting that way, and he feels like he's got the quote unquote sale, you know, within his grasp. He's already thinking about that move that is supposed to happen hours later. He's not thinking in your best interest. He's thinking in terms of his. And the people that have an uncomfortable time with sales are uncomfortable because it's all about you. You're only thinking about yourself and what you can get from that interaction. And that's why you feel like a piece of shit. And that's why you feel selfish. If you make it about the other person, like Megan did, like you did with this person, then it's not sleazy at all. It's easy. And so you're in a profession where it's actually, people find it very difficult. I know a ton of journalists who initially start out and they have a tough time dealing with the rejection and dealing with the deadlines and all this stuff. But you managed to make it work on a really huge level. You know, we didn't get into it because we didn't have time, but I know like, you know, it wasn't always what you wanted it to be. Or it wasn't always what you thought it would be, right? It didn't always lead to overwhelming amounts of joy, and you know, it was hard. You know, it wasn't everything you hoped. But I still think your story is really admirable, and everybody can learn from it. Which is, you know, you set out to get what you want, and I took a ton of notes. I'm going to do a real quick recap. On some of the stuff we talked about, because I think it's worth highlighting again. Excuse me. You started out, you know, in special ed because you were struggling with reading, and you actually, as you went on, you made it so you explored in your early adulthood, I guess, what writing was like, what it meant to you. You're writing about failed romances. You didn't even get into photography until college. But you explored this stuff, and you loved working within the community of journalism and working with other people. And you got a chance to train by people side by side and have those early apprenticeships. And you had those early wins of writing an essay when you're 16. And then somebody, by mere circumstance at your homecoming, announced that you were going to go on to become a journalist. So you had these early wins, but you took notice of the fact that, you know, writing and telling stories was part of who you were. It tapped into your philosophical side, your thinking, but it also allowed you to do what you were passionate about, which was to explore the world and to interact with other people. And so it touched deeply on who you were as a person, and it just allowed you to be a vessel for who you were. And what I think was really cool that you did was you actually listened to your intuition in spite of everyone around you telling you that you needed to get a real job, that you weren't doing the right thing, and that your friends had real jobs and they had money and things were set for them. But you felt the pain of not exploring what you really wanted to do. And my favorite line from this was, the worst case scenario was I would have a bad week-long vacation. seriously, that's like, that's exactly it. And then you set out, you figured out if this, then that, what to do if there was a worst case scenario. You figured all that stuff out so you didn't have any excuses and you had people holding you accountable. Then you raised the exact amount of money that you needed, which I think is so important. People need to pick a specific dollar amount for their goals, for their ambitious goals, the stuff that's really meaningful to them. And then you made that shit happen. You took on a bunch of jobs, including cocktailing at a tranny bar, and which I didn't know about you, which is great. And then the whole world kind of opened up to you, and all these serendipitous things started happening when you got momentum doing the things that you wanted to do. And I've found that's the case every single time I'm doing something I want to do as well. I have a clear path. I'm on my way in the world. It's crazy. It's like a law. The world kind of bends to your will and carves a path for you to make it happen more efficiently. And all of a sudden you were getting paid by other countries, all expenses trip, to make stuff for them because you had a gift. By that time you were good, and you were sharing it with others, and others wanted your gift even more. And you worked hard, and you were hungry enough to work your ass off to make this happen. And once again, I mean, I think you encapsulated the sales aspect of this so hard, which selling is not convincing or manipulating another person into getting something that they want. It's not a win-lose scenario. It's a win-win. And the way you do that is by starting off by getting to know people and developing a relationship with them and having their best interest in mind by simply hearing them out and listening to them, listening to their story, what they're going through, and asking about them. Because once you get to know them, if you'd gotten to know that one lady who worked for the Huffington Post and she was like, you know, I need this type of story, I need these types of photos, and that wasn't something you could provide, you would have pointed her in the right direction, which wouldn't have been you. You know, you would have just helped her. So, those were the main takeaways I took from this call. It was a huge, huge help, I think, and a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this. There's a ton to take away. So thank you very much, Megan, for sharing all this. This was great.
Thanks, Charlie. And that was a good summary. I hope you write my obituary one day. That was really
I hope you'll mind, because then maybe it'll end up in the National Geographic or something like that. So.